Welcome to episode 301 of WordPress Weekly for Wednesday, January 17, 2017. I'm your host, Jeff Chandler, joined by Jay Tripp, or Jay with exponential 3 in his name. I don't know. You're changing your Twitter name or avatar or whatever the hell it is every week, you know. But welcome back, John. I'm back. You can actually understand my voice this week. This time last week, I was under the weather, to put it mildly. It was god awful. I don't know what I have to think. I had part of the plague that was going around, and I work remotely. So how is that possible?
I like when you're sick because I get a week off.
Oh, beautiful.
So
that's great. Now, not only do you get a week off, but HeroPress stats go up, as I found out.
That's funny. It does inconvenience our guest, though, who is forced to reserve 2 time slots, by the way. So it's very nice.
It actually worked out for our guest. So nanny. So how do you like that? great to be back with you all this week. A lot of stuff that's been happening, and had a lot of great feedback for our 300th episode with Matt Mulloway. Definitely give that a listen if you have a chance, or if you haven't listened to it yet. Because Matt's audio was perfect throughout that interview. And that's a rarity here on WordPress Weekly when we interview him.
It only took 300 episodes to get perfect audio, and finally got it covered.
That's right. So we do have an iTunes review to cover, and it is a 5-star review, John. And it's actually by a guy named John. It's not you. I don't think it's you. Good. But he says, Jeff and John, congratulations on episode 300. Thanks for all that you do for the WordPress community. And that was from John Parkinson, who himself is an awesome member of the WordPress community. So thank you, John, for the review.
Thanks, John.
And thank you for the work you do for WordPress.tv. I know he does a lot of work over there, contributes. Mm-hmm. That's his way of contributing to the WordPress community. Let's see.
That was like your birthday gift. That was like your birthday gift review. Your one review.
Yes.
Your one the one listener to this show decided to grace us with a 5-star review.
We have more than one listener. Trust me, I know, because they told me and I insulted them for listening to the show, which we've already covered.
We did cover that. You're not allowed to do that ever again.
Part of my New Year's resolution to be humble and respond to positive with positive, not negative. So that's something we're working on. Anyways, we got an awesome guest today. Her name is Rachel Cherry, formerly known as Rachel Carden. She is a senior software engineer for Disney Interactive with over 10 years experience.
I've never heard of Disney. Yeah. Who's Disney? We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that.
I think it's just a channel on TV. I don't know. In back and front end web development and digital design before Disney, she spent over 9 years working in higher education and is the director of WP Campus, a community and conference focused on using WordPress in the world of higher education. And her bio goes on for a mile long because that's how awesome she is. But we'll cut it there and we'll let her get into it and tell us a little bit about her story. But Rachel, thank you very much for being on the show. Glad to have you on.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So, let's start off at the very beginning here. I believe this is your first time on WordPress Weekly. So congratulations.
I have now made it in life. There's nowhere else to go.
Yes. Finally had a chance to meet you in person at WordCamp US briefly, but it was a great interaction. Let's start off with your origin experience. How did you first get involved with WordPress?
So I first started using WordPress in higher ed. I've worked at 3 universities, the last one being the University of Alabama, Roll Tide. And when I first got the job, pretty much the rule for getting the job was I had to learn WordPress because it was a CMS they were using. And I was familiar with CMSs, but I had maybe had like 10 minutes experience with WordPress. I think I fixed some PHP bug in some random blog that my aunt owned or something.
And what year was this?
Well, it was January of 2011 is my first WordPress foray. And so I had about 6 months to learn WordPress. basically migrate an entire library of Word websites. So I work for the College of Engineering. So they have about like seven or eight departments. So it was the main website and the website for each department. So about seven, eight, nine websites total. Migrate them all off of Cold Fusion and into WordPress. Then I had to build the theme. So I had a parent theme, which was the main website, and I had a child theme that was all the departments. And then I had to build out all the plugin functionality. It was higher ed, so you know we had directories and all this stuff. And I did all that in like 6 months.
Wow, that was a talk about a crash course, huh?
Yeah, it was a deep dive. It wasn't pretty, but it worked. And then I always say the pretty came later, but it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I think I went to my first WordCamp that year too in Birmingham.
So I'm just curious that's a hell of a deep dive, you know, a really crash course into WordPress. Throughout that project, when it came time to look for help or get help, did you do a lot of Google food? Did you rely on the codex a lot? Did you find that a lot of the resources or information that was out there on the web was still accurate related to WordPress?
I think it was pretty much all the above. Probably a lot of Google foo. I imagine a lot of codex. I was early days of Twitter then, so I think Twitter is maybe how I even discovered WordCamps existed. Like, so not too much Twitter interaction, maybe a little bit, but so a lot of just Googling, a lot of like Codex Stack Overflow type scenarios, probably a lot of blogs, you know, like Justin Tadlock. I remember reading a lot of his site. You know, he lives in Alabama, and so that was kind of neat that there was this a lot of WordPress resource there in my home state. And so
he's on my bucket list.
a lot of blogs and stuff like that too.
Did you end up using WordPress multi-site when you made this move?
Yes. This was right after 3.0. So I had like custom post types, thankfully too. And definitely it was a multi-site.
That is the best way to come into WordPress. That is how I came into WordPress. So it's like the most challenging entry point, but you ramp up so quickly, and then your comfort level with multiple sites and all of it just comes as like a baseline. You don't have to like ramp up to it because you just assume that that's what it is.
That's just how it works.
Yep.
It was great. It was subdomains. It's still going, although I redesigned it right before I left. There was a lot of, in hindsight, you know, looking back when I rebuilt it, like, there was a lot of stuff that I didn't do the WordPress way because I was in such a hurry, or I didn't know there was a better way to do it. So things like that, you know, like I said, it worked, but it definitely kind of threw me in the deep end, and I had to learn quick, which I think is a great way to learn.
Mm-hmm. So we mentioned in the bio something called WP Campus, and I love the story, the genesis of this, and I want you to tell it in your own words. But basically, it started off as a tweet that's now turned into something of a reality with these conferences. So tell us a little bit about the genesis of WP Campus and the inspiration behind it.
Yeah, it is a great story. It was August of 2015, which is kind of crazy that we're in our third year. But I was still in higher ed. I was at the University of Alabama. And I believe there was some big announcement that just came out about WordCamp US, and that was in Philadelphia. I think that was the first one. Is that the first one?
Yeah.
And so there was lots of tweets going around, and the hashtag, it looked like WordCampus. And so I believe it was Chris Lemma. He tweeted that. Pretty much that sentiment that when he sees it, he just thinks of WordCampus. And when I saw that tweet, the light bulb just came on. Like, wouldn't that be amazing if there was a WordCamp about higher education? And because one of my, like, not really a struggle, but one of the things that I usually dealt with going to WordCamps is that I would get something out of it. And I loved being around the people and I would enjoy some of the sessions, but for the most part, no one was talking about the kind of stuff that I wanted to talk about, the stuff that I dealt with. And there wasn't really a network there to talk about that kind of stuff. And so why this idea hadn't come to me before. I don't, you know, that was the moment. It was like, wow, that would be great. And so I tweeted the idea out and it just kind of rolled down the hill from there. It got a lot of attention. I set up a website to kind of get into a Slack account and kind of put like a general landing page up. The very first website was very boring. I wish I had like a screenshot of it. But it, and so it evolved, and then it became this idea of, why don't we have a conference? You know, why don't we plan the conference? And why don't we have this community that's year round? It can be more than just, you know, one event a year. We can have this great network. We can provide resources. And so it went from there. And by next summer, so that was August, by the next summer, July, mid-July, we had our first conference. And it was in Sarasota, Florida. We had about 150 people. It was really great. It was a great event. We were able to keep the cost pretty low, things like that. We've had two in-persons now, and we still look back at that first year that it was just really something special. Like, it's going to be hard to like top that, even though every year is great. But the second year, this past summer, we were in Buffalo, New York at Canisius College. And then we also started doing online conferences because kind of like, why not? We had the technology. It's so easy to do. And it makes it kind of, introduces a level of accessibility to being able to not only consume the information, but to speak. So like, we have a lot of speakers, travel, budgets, time, it's tough, especially in higher ed. And so we want everyone to have the opportunity to be able to speak, even if it means they can't travel. So that's kind of what kicked off the online conference and why we love doing it. And so that's coming up this month. We're having our second one on January the 30th. And so we're really excited about it. It's a free event all day from 9 a.m. Central to 5 p.m. Central. And there's two rooms. So there's 16 sessions, and there's a chat room that you can pop in. You can talk to the speakers, all that kind of stuff. So it's really like being in person, except you do miss out on that in-person networking, things like that. But with the internet now, I don't feel like you're really, you know, you're not missing out on too much. It's also a great opportunity in between the in-person to just chit-chat with each other and share knowledge and things like that. So we really enjoy putting it on. We're really excited about it.
And did you end up having financial support or any type of support through the I want to say WordPress, the WordPress community? It's WCS. It's a subsidiary now of the foundation, but the people who help finance WordCamps, did you have any support from them on putting on this event?
Oh no, we do it all on our own. We're a nonprofit. Okay. And so we raised all the money on our own. And then obviously, and then we have the help of sponsorships. There's a lot of great companies that are really involved. They want to support what we're doing, whether or not they actually do anything with higher ed. But we do have a lot of businesses that actually are very involved in higher ed, and they want to be a part of it. So we do have some great like company sponsors and stuff like that to keep the lights on, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
Throughout the first year of organizing this event, what are some of the challenges that you overcame, or maybe you didn't account for that you got through that helped put on an even better second event?
So thankfully, I had organized conferences before. I had organized, actually, I'd helped organize WordCamp Birmingham, but also I had helped organize some higher education conferences. So I personally was fairly comfortable with kind of like what needed to happen, things like that. And so there wasn't too many crazy surprises. There was definitely an extra added on challenge of planning an event in a city that you don't live in. And we had a few people on the ground to help with some stuff, like help us find social events and things like that. But, you know, it was a lot of phone calls and things like that. A lot of, will you take pictures of that for me so I can see it? We actually had one person walk around, you know, with a camera and take a bunch of videos of the space so that we would know what to expect when we got there and what it would look like and feel like. We didn't have too many problems. We haven't had that many issues. One of my biggest lessons I learned from the second year was just to rent a car. first year I had a car in Florida because my mom drove down from Alabama, which was really sweet of her. And she helped run errands and stuff, but she couldn't come to Buffalo. And so I was like, oh, I'll just use an Uber or Lyft or whatever and get around. No. Not only that, but it rained. It rained. And so my plan was like to walk. I was like, oh, I'll just walk across the street and then I'll Lyft back. I couldn't walk across the street because it was pouring. So I literally had to like get in a Lyft just to drive across the street. But, you know, things like that. So that was one of my biggest lessons I learned. Just even basic things like that. A lot of the issues usually just come in the details, you know, and and as much as you can do beforehand, the better. The more communicative you can be, the better. I have like checklists upon checklists, and I have like a timeline of the day, like this needs to happen, and I go down the list. Things like that. So we didn't have too many crazy problems, you know, working with the school to make sure the Wi-Fi is great, making sure someone's on hand in case there are issues, things like that. Like, it's just kind of a lot of minor details and making sure everything's.
I feel like the WordPress community is pretty lucky with how and fortunate with how all of the events tend to go off pretty smoothly, like all of the time. But I'm curious if, since you have experience planning a regular WordCamp, like everyone knows and is familiar with mostly, and with a private, your own nonprofit event with a targeted niche sort of audience compared to a WordCamp, what the differences are on the organizational side, like because it's still WordPress based, is it largely kind of the same? Or have you found that because it's a specific to higher ed that it's a completely different type of conference?
It's fairly similar. I wouldn't say that there's too many differences. For us, really, I guess like the big perk to being private is that we can be more flexible. Mm-hmm. We can, you know, we are in control of our decisions. So like, we're not bound by maybe some of the rules that like some WordCamps are bound to, just because, mostly just because WordCamps have to kind of fit a template to, you know, to fit into the mass, you know, planning that they have to control with a small team. And I totally get that. So like we're a little more flexible in that regard, but with that said, like it's fairly similar event. And so I really wouldn't say there's anything that we do that's just crazy out of the box that other, that other camps do. Because in the end, they're all, like most conferences all kind of have the same general spiel. And so like we're going to try a few new things this year. We're going to try a few things like before the event to kind of prepare for the event. We're hoping to add a third day this year that will be like workshops and stuff. Nice. Before we actually had the workshops and in the schedule. So it was like this experiment to like workshops took up two blocks. And so like
interesting,
you know, and I think that worked okay. Like there wasn't anything really bad about it, but this year, if we can't, like we can add a third day, we're going to try that this year and see people want to do a workshop and they just come a day early kind of thing. And we're going to try some few different things like to keep the day off. But I don't think these ideas or anything like WordCamps could do or don't do. Right. Like it's just on our
end. Are all the sessions like WordPress focused with like a higher end twist, or are like, cause you know, someone might give a security talk, but then that they're going to share their experience having performed WordPress security in higher ed, or are they really more higher ed first and then WordPress second, or is it a mix, or what did you end up with?
So we do have a goal we aim for when we're actually going through speaker submissions. What we're aiming for is like half like WordPress, half higher ed, like, and so that's like the first question of like the first sorting. We want to make sure we have a good mix of both. But then if we're going to have to get more granular about it, like if we have, you know, 100 plus submissions for like 30 slots, the one question we then ask ourselves is, could you find this talk at any WordCamp? And if the answer is yes, then it moves down the priority list. Because, I mean, that's kind of like, So like example, you know, a lot of people will, you'll get submissions for like really basic, like dev talks, like learn this WP CLI, which is great. It's a great talk. It's a great topic. I love the WP CLI, but you can probably get that talk at like every other WordCamp on the circuit. And it's probably, there's probably 30 of them on WordCamp TV. Yep. And so the like half the point of our event is that we're giving this outlet to discussions you can't find at WordCamps. So we do that. Those will move down the list in for priority for something that's more specific to higher ed.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So that's kind of where we go down the list of our little speaker matrix, so to speak. So we do want to have a good mix because we also understand that the web is the web. And, you know, we are at the end of the day building, you know, we're building websites that do take in a lot of factors and a lot of attributes and a lot of technologies that are just general web technologies and not higher ed technologies. But then we do want to take that stuff and we want to frame it in how this could help serve us in the space of higher ed. So it's a good, it's a little bit of a balancing act and things like that. But I we do end up finding some really great topics. A lot of, I'm excited about the online event. We're going to have a lot of case studies. And so things like that, which are always really fun to hear about because you just would never think of some of the stuff these, you know, these great people are coming up with and how they're using WordPress and how they're using these different technologies. And so we do find a pretty good combination of content.
Well, I want to get into a little bit about, you know, the whole WordPress and higher ed scene. And one of the things I thought was very interesting is that before the first inaugural WP campus took place, the organizing team, of course, that you're a part of, had this conducted a survey to learn how WordPress was used in higher education. And it had a total of about 486 people who responded to the survey. And there were some very interesting results, I think, in that survey where, you know, for instance, 18% of respondents said scalability is a barrier to being accepted at their school. And 37% of respondents said that WordPress's reputation of being just a blogging platform hindered its ability to be the platform of choice. And the general theme of the survey was that there were a lot of misconceptions, general misconceptions of WordPress that still exist today that was hampering its ability to be widely adopted in these higher education environments. Maybe you could give us your take on that, on the results from that survey.
There are definitely stigmas about WordPress in higher ed. And I do think they're getting better, but especially when I started in 2011, they were very much there. And it was a struggle in our IT department. And so some of the big ones are security is a big stigma, because what would happen is people would set up just kind of random WordPress installs on campus, like a random professor. What all they'd have to do is like submit a form to IT, and IT would be like, here. And the professor would set up their blog and they'd be all excited about it for like a week. And then they would stop working on it, or they'd leave the university, or something would happen like that. And then all of a sudden there's this site sitting there that no one's responsible for and that wasn't audited, taken down. And then 2 years later, it gets hacked because it was never updated, you know, and now there's auto updates, which help to an extent, but those weren't around then. And so so all these higher education WordPress installs are getting hacked all the time. And which leads me to like the second stigma, which is so like, remember back when like the big WordPress marketing, you know, campaign was like, oh, how easy it is.
I think 5 minute install.
5 minute install. It's so easy. It's so easy to maintain websites. And so I think that that kind of, especially in the higher ed space, bit WordPress in the butt a little bit, because a lot of schools with low resources and budgets, and, you know, they looked at that as, well, we don't need to hire a person to manage our websites. We can just set up WordPress. And so they would throw up all these websites, stuff like that, without anyone responsible for maintaining them. And then you still get in the same issue where sites are getting hacked or they're not being updated. Or then you get into the, you know, the problem where they're not being maintained and updated. They're not being watched out for accessibility and other legal concerns in higher ed. And so there was, you know, there was this kind of So there's definitely like a stigma about it in higher ed where like it was just, you don't have to throw much money at it. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to put people on it, like whatever. And so there was, you know, there was definitely some issues with that. You know, we would have, you know, we would have struggles with just getting like people in place like that. And so lots of stuff kind of adding up together. And then you kind of added up to a lot of problems with WordPress in higher ed in general. And so I think it's getting better, but I do remember that when I started, like there's also, because of those issues, you know, you just, a lot of higher ed is also like politics and things like that. If you don't have governance in place, you're going to have issues. And so it's also just all the harder to get the tools you need to use it. And it's just, it's just ongoing. And so you know, what has to happen is you just is a communication and talking about it, sitting down. You have to have people in place of responsibility that understand IT and know what's going on and understand the value of it and what's needed to maintain it and resource it, things like that. And so I think over time it's getting better. The more people, the, you know, the less, you know, hacking and things like that that happen, the more you have someone sitting down with an IT person and going, no, you know, that's not a WordPress problem. That's our problem. You know, that's things like that, and recognizing where the blame lies and when it, you know, doesn't lie with WordPress itself, but with your internal systems and processes and your lack of governance. So, so that's an ongoing discussion that's had a lot. It's happening a lot in higher ed. You know, a lot of people have to have buy-in. They have to, like, their first step isn't, you know, the 5-minute install. Their first step is talking to the IT director and getting buy-in with their managers and their executives, things like that, to get permission to just use it. Right. And discussing the value of using something like WordPress over a proprietary system, where you're going to have less control and you're not going to own your content, things like that. I think higher ed's a great place for open source because they do share a very similar kind of underlying philosophy of just kind of open publishing and open education, things like that. And so it's a great environment for it, but you still have to kind of jump through some bureaucratic hurdles and all that.
Yeah, I remember when we had a guest on, I believe it was for the New Jersey public school system or school system in Pennsylvania, but he was talking about how basically outlining the difficulties and the friction involved in trying to convince an entire school district to switch away from a proprietary system that was costing the district hundreds of thousands of dollars to maintain and just licensing fees and whatnot to WordPress was, you know, one of the hardest things, you know, that he's ever had to do, but he actually successfully did it. And now he's saving the district tons of money and the sites are actually a lot easier to maintain and to update and keep the design up to date and what have you. So
that happens all over the place. We talk about that with even in the small town government type of space where our website that we use for the village that I live in, there is a company that provides municipal websites for every sort of city and town and village all over the place. And I can't be the only person who tries to start a conversation like, let's move everything to WordPress. But then when our municipally owned library wants a new website, they have their own third-party service that they outsource all their web stuff to. And so trying to convince everyone that, like, hey, we might be able to solve this problem ourselves, like cheaply and with higher quality results, or just by doing a little bit more work and owning it, that we can provide kind of a better experience for everyone. But it's, I can't be the only person who does it, right? Like, so being the only person at a school who's championing WordPress and this move when it does it involves so many different departments and stakeholders and it sounds super, super challenging. I know people that have done it year over year that are friends of probably all of ours that the one thing that WordPress has going for it for higher ed really is multi-site. I feel like it just flows and fits the academic space so well because there's always multiple groups, multiple sites and stakeholders, and people are using them for different reasons, where the multi-tenancy that comes with Django or Drupal or other CMSs is adequate, but isn't like a first-rate sort of experience like WordPress's multi-site is, where I think everyone starts off with multi-site in higher ed, and that is good that there's a solution, but it ends up being problematic because it is a huge sell. It's a big buy-in to get everyone to commit to that. I think like that's you coming in on multi-site is like no shock because it just is the way that it goes all the time.
It's a really big higher ed probably might be one of the biggest like use cases of multi-site. It's amazing how much it's used. Some of the most common examples are like faculty publishing platforms. Mm-hmm. So like if you're a professor, you can, you know, it's great. It's like you have this office with like a dev or two, maybe a designer or whatever, set up a multi-site, build one or two, three, you know, themes, have a library of approved plugins. And then, you know, it's a very much of a simple workflow. You have a fill out a form and they get on the network and maybe they're required to do a little bit of education first about how to manage their content. They pick their, you know, their theme from the pre-approved list. They have pre-approved plugins. They can't, you know, do anything too crazy. And it's a very controlled, maintained environment that also can very easily be kept up to date because it's all one code base, core code base, things like that. So it's really great. Platform for higher ed. It's used in faculty networks and like student publishing networks, but also as marketing sites. I mean, most of colleges, because all colleges, not all of them, but most of them are built in a very similar way where, you know, say arts and sciences, you know, like you have your main arts and sciences site, but then you have a site for every single department. And if you're the University of Alabama, that's like 20 something departments. So each site is a sub site on your network. And they all share themes that way they all look similar and have similar functionality. It's not too crazy to keep up to date and add features, things like that. So it's a really great tool for higher ed. Definitely very much used.
I want to switch gears a little bit because higher ed is just one of the passions you have. The other is accessibility. And there has been a lot of conversations lately with various lawsuits going on throughout the world and various organizations, whether that's educational or government, regarding accessibility. Tell us a little bit about your background with web accessibility and why is this one of your passions on the web?
So I got started with it because of higher ed. So if you work for a university that receives any kind of federal funding, so most state universities, you are required by law, Section 508, to be a certain level of accessible. All of your technology has to be, not just your websites. And so that's where I got started. And our websites had to be Section 508 accessible. And so it was part of my workflow because it had to be. But then it was part of my workflow because it should be. And it should be something on all our minds all the time and something that we consider in every part of our workflow before we even get started with a project. What a lot of people do is they wait till the very end. They finish a website, and then all of a sudden they run some accessibility scans and realize that they've got to fix a bunch of stuff. And that's when it can become a little daunting. So if you kind of think of it from the beginning, integrate it into your design, you know, make accessibility scans part of it, like a daily habit over your code, and then it's much easier and it's much smaller fixes and it's much less scary. But to add to that, Section 508, as of this month, I think maybe today, I think the 17th, Section 508 now is the same. The guidelines are the same as WCAG, which is the other kind of guideline body. And so now they're one, where before government funded entities were Section 508 and then everyone else kind of followed WCAG 2.0. Now they're the same, which is really great. Mixing's a little simpler. They weren't that different, but they were different enough. And so now all, if you were Section 508, now you follow WCAG 2.0 AA. And so that's really great, kind of evens things out. But essentially what accessibility means is just, it's a philosophy of web user design interaction, things like that. to ensure that your content and your functionality is accessible to everyone, no matter, you know, their abilities or disabilities. I also like to refer to it, or most people like to refer to it as just simply universal design, designing mm-hmm. in a way that just includes everyone from the get-go, as opposed to, like, you know, just kind of ad hoc-ing fixes on later to cover very specific pain points. And so it's just, it is a big passion of mine for good reason. It's just, I think it's just how we should all look at the web, how we should all just kind of think about what we're building.
And back in, 2016, I think there was an announcement where the WordPress accessibility coding standards were approved for the core handbook, and apparently all newer updated code released on WordPress must conform with the WCAG 2.0 guidelines at level AA, which a lot of people championed and applauded them for. What do you think? What is your bird's eye view of accessibility in WordPress? And do you see it as, I mean, from your perspective, is it, do you see it as a sort of first class priority in WordPress, or do you think it's still one of those back burner type things?
I think it's definitely working its way up in core. There's a really great accessibility team. I've been trying to join their meetings and get more involved, and been helping where I can. Submitted a couple of tickets for WordPress.org where I noticed that it was inaccessible, but so things like that. And it's a great team to be a part of if you want to get involved in the WordPress Slack channel and join the meetings and help with tickets and do discussions. I was really excited to see, you know, when Gutenberg first came out, there was a lot of accessibility alarm bells, which was, a little frustrating, but they've stepped up their game and really added a lot of cool stuff to it. And so that was neat to see in Nashville, the color contrast checking, being able to check headings and things like that. And so you definitely see a movement, and movement is movement. We take what we can get. And so we're heading in the right direction. I think the struggle right now where we are struggling is more like in plugins and themes. Like core's making movement, but until we have some kind of policy about like plugins and themes or some kind of integrated testing or... I mean, it's easier. It's hard for plugins because plugins provide such a wide array of functionality. But it's not impossible to do something. Mm. And then with themes, like I know that in the .org theme repository, I don't really hang out there too much because I build my own themes. But I do know there's an accessibility tag for a theme that's accessible. But I don't think it's like, I'm pretty sure it's not like a requirement for your theme to be accessible just to be in the repository, but that would be cool. You know, like that would be a huge step.
But if we had these types of guidelines, wouldn't it also, I mean, wouldn't you just kind of look at that and shake your head and go, boy, it's a shame it had to come to this to get people to realize accessibility is this important, or to just have it be a default thing that we need to implement guidelines for this to happen?
You know, I think about that every time that I hear someone say, look both ways before you cross the street. You'd think you wouldn't have to say that. And then you'd think that even like as an adult that you would have that like emblazoned in your memory and mind that like, don't walk out into the street. How many times when you're out in public, do you just watch people meander out into the street? Like not even on their phones. They're just not paying attention. Like it's... simple stuff, but I think you have to do it. Like
I have a friend also named Rachel who is really great. She works on accessibility and she gives this great talk that I love, and it's basically called something like carrots and sticks. And so you start with the carrots in the hope that you can convince and encourage people of the benefits of accessibility, that it's not, you know, just about, you know, making your websites inclusive, but there are some benefits. At the heart of it, really good accessibility is really good markup. And so there are benefits that come with that of having a more performant website, SEO benefits, things like that. And and your if your site is more inclusive, and let's say you're an e-commerce site, your site's inclusive, you're going to have more clients and more sales because they can actually access your products. So things like that. So you kind of work through that at first, and you hope that that catches on, and you hope that that's enough carrot to get someone to care about accessibility. But then if that doesn't work, you take out the stick and you talk about all the legal problems.
you hit them over the head with it.
You sadly have to scare some people with lawsuits and talk about how many lawsuits there have been. They're obviously more, I mean, there's a bigger history of them when it comes to like government entities. There's lots of higher ed examples, things like that. But more and more now there are civil suits. Just because it's not illegal to be inaccessible doesn't mean that you won't have civil suits brought against you for being inaccessible. A big example being a recent one from last year where Winn-Dixie was sued. And if you're not familiar with Winn-Dixie, because I realize out here, no one in California knows who Winn-Dixie is. And I had to learn that through a funny conversation. But it's a grocery store chain in the South. And I grew up in Alabama with Winn-Dixie's. And so last year, they were sued over their website being inaccessible. And what the judge ruled in favor against Winn-Dixie, whatever the terminology is, they ruled for the person suing and said that their store, because there was a lot of functionality on their website about their store, like a store locator and things like that, that involved the store, that the website was in a sense, a part of the store and basically a requirement for, I guess, the physicalness of the store. And so ruled that it belonged under the ADA and that they had to make their website accessible. Hmm. Not only, it went even further to say, which is a big stickler for a lot of people to notice, pay attention to, is that they ruled that third-party components on your website also had to be accessible. Which is where a lot of people in their mind draw a line that, oh, it's not my component. I'm not responsible for it. But this judge ruled that they were and that the site, the component had to be accessible in order to be used. So, example, if you use any kind of like single sign-on login modal pop-ups from other part, you know, other software sources, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so this was a big kind of landmark web accessibility civil case that we could see more of because now there's a precedent for it. And so I do like to a little bit of a spiel that I give about like e-commerce. So let's say you have an e-commerce WordPress website. Let's say you love, you know, you use WooCommerce, you sell your products, blah, blah, blah. That's pretty big. And so I like to put it in this framework. So you sell these products, you only sell them online. But let's say you had a storefront. Let's say you only had a storefront. And you had a client who had trouble getting inside your store. So they can't get through the door or they get inside, but there's a step and they can't get to the cashier. And they use Apple Pay. So they have to be at the cashier. They can't just hand you their card. They have to, but so basically you're standing there in person with this other person, with this human. And if that was the case, if that was happening, like, and how would that make you feel? Like, how would that make you feel if someone was coming into your store and your store was inaccessible to them? They couldn't check out. They couldn't get around. They couldn't get to the cashier. So I feel like, you know, a lot of people, that would just be horrible. And you would be doing everything you could in that moment to fix that. But in the day of the internet, in the great big old day of the internet we're having right now, a lot of stuff's happening online where there's that wall. There's that, you know, the struggles we have a lot with the internet these days is that there's a wall between everyone. People do a lot of things online they wouldn't do in person. But, you know, we have that wall where you don't see that person struggling to access your website, struggling. They can't even check out because your checkout button is not accessible, things like that. And so they get frustrated and they leave. And so not only are they frustrated, they're thinking they have a negative emotions about your store, but you've lost a sale. And so I try to kind of paint that picture for a lot of people that have a hard time putting accessibility into a frame of mind that relates to what they're doing on the web.
And the reason I really like the using that analogy for this is that it it plays really well with like why net neutrality is such a big deal and why it matters so much. Because in the real world, when your stairs are out of compliance, or when the door to your store is out of compliance, there is either a inspector or a compliance officer or someone who's responsible for inspecting your business before you can even open the doors. And so the real world implication applied to the web, where imagine if we weren't net neutral and before you could launch your website, there was a person who had to inspect everything and say, this button's out of compliance, the sidebar is not in compliance, your footer is out of compliance, this is wrong, contrast is wrong, the logo is too big, too small, whatever, 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 whatever. And you just literally were not allowed to launch a website on the web without someone else inspecting it. Now, big companies internally have standards, and they have the luxury of dollars and cents and experts and professionals to go through that process. But to turn that into a requirement for launching a website on the web goes against all of the freedoms that the internet currently and historically has stood for. And the argument that the and the precedent that the Winn-Dixie case sets is that the web is going towards less freedom and more regulation instead of being more free and less people in the way. And so there, I think there's probably a happy middle there, but at the same time, the expectation of you have a brick and mortar store and we expect for doors and steps to work correctly, right? Like if you've ever read the Norman Doors, the Design of Everyday Things, like having doors that don't open the right way or the handles are the wrong way. Like these are things that compliance officers will suggest that you fix and eventually come back and review you for. But the way we all learned how to write code and be developers is because we didn't have that regulation that blocked us every time we wanted to learn how to do something. So we're in a funny spot with the web and accessibility and those things that people perceive as being like little extra plus ones, because the real world has been dealing with this for decades and the web has been dealing with it not at all. And so where does that middle ground end up? I'm thinking of you too, because I didn't know that you dealt with 508 stuff. That was like my original WordPress theme was a terrible, I mean, it was as 508 compliant as any WordPress theme was at the time. And I think I even had like wp508.com, which is how I met.
I did not know that existed.
That's totally super dead. There's like no Google juice on it at all or anything. But that's how I met Ian Stewart, who's from Automatic, was because he was dealing and working on something at the time. And so to circle this all back around, the point that you made about it sort of being simpler markup and universally coded to be very slim and accessible from the get-go. BuddyPress and bbpress.org's theme is like rooted in that WP508 theme. It's never came up as like a topic of conversation, but if you look at BuddyPress.org and bbpress.org, you'll see all the little like old school 508 bits that haven't been updated in like 4 years. But
that's great. Yeah. Well, so like you look at like a really basic accessibility checklist kind of thing, or you know, the more you work into it and more you think about this kind of stuff, I always really encourage people to adopt some kind of scanning tool into your workflow, because the great thing about most of them is that they don't just tell you what's wrong. They tell you why it's wrong and they tell you how to fix it. So mm-hmm. over time you just start to learn and you're making a difference, you know, from the get go. And so, but with all that said, a lot of it's just like really, it's surprising how much of it is just really basic, like HTML, like invalid HTML. So a big example being a lot of people will use like action elements, like A elements for incorrectly. So I tweeted about this recently, and basically, it's if you have, let's say you're wanting to open like a modal on your page. And so it's really just like a button to trigger some JavaScript and, you know, all this stuff. And so it's invalid to use an A element that has an href attribute with like a pound sign that just opens a modal, because that's an invalid, that's an URL that goes nowhere is essentially the way to describe it. So which is inaccessible. That's the wrong element to use. You know, what you should be using is an actual button element, or you should be using like a span element that you give it a role of button. But it needs to, it also needs to have some kind of signification that this is a button and it's doing buttony type things, as opposed to a link that doesn't go anywhere. And so things like that. A lot of it's just these really small details that in the end make your site more accessible, but also, you know, make you a better developer, because you're thinking about these little nuances to HTML that maybe you didn't think about before, because you did learn from like copying and pasting off Stack Overflow or something. And which is, you know, a lot of us learn from just doing on the internet. And so now comes a time where we kind of polish it up a little bit, you know, and do things like that. So
that's the Gutenberg concern originally too, right? Is by pulling in all of these components and by pulling in a bunch of React libraries and by choosing exactly what part of the output that we want to own or not own, and any other like modern web app kind of is sort of just everything's a div. Everything all the time is a div. Your text area is a div. Like your everything just happened is because it's just you have more control over it. It's just easier. There's just nested markup soup all over the place. And coming from, you know, humble 508 beginnings, it really drives me a little mental, like seeing how just junky the web apps have sort of been forced to be to cobble around a lot of the CSS limitations that we've had before we had the box modeling that we have now and everything else. So it's getting better, but you're right that it still does require a lot of discussion and education and really just evangelizing why it's important. Because it is actually easier. Like, that's the part of it that has always boggled my mind with accessibility, is like, if you know how to, if you understand how it works, then you actually do like way less work by just doing it right and clean and simple from the get-go, instead of really making it harder on yourself trying to, you know, make it more complicated. So I'll
challenge everyone that's listening to this specific test. Open up your website. You are not allowed to use your mouse. You are only allowed to use your keyboard. Can you access all of the functionality? Can you type everywhere? Can you submit forms? Can you do everything you could do with a mouse with only your keyboard? Can you, if you open a modal, can you close it and get back to where you were in the first place? Things like that. And that can be a really, not only an eye opener, but can be a great walkthrough to kind of make a list to start with. Even if you just fix those issues, and that's like your first homework assignment, Rachel's accessibility homework assignments, day one. that's your first assignment. That can make a big impact on your site. And can also just make your site, that goes back to the whole universal design incorporation, because really you're making your website better for everyone, because a lot of people just use their keyboard to navigate. Like, I know a lot of devs do, because it's easier and quicker if you can just tab, tab, tab and get through. Then it's just, you're making a better experience for everyone, not just people who can't use a mouse or are using assistive devices that pretty much they can only really tap through your site and interact with keyboard-like controls. So I encourage everyone to do that and see what it's like on your site. Other big changes are like the big ones people generally talk about are like having alt attributes for images, but really it comes down to having text alternatives to non-text content. So images are a big one, but you also have videos. You know, do your videos have captions? Does your audio files have transcriptions? Things like that. Do you have infographics? Because those were really big there for a few years, infographics. But is there a text version of your the info in your infographic? If someone can't see that infographic, will they still get the same data? Things like that. So there's lots of there's some really great checklists out there and things like that, resources to kind of walk you through when you're getting started on a project. And it's helpful to just kind of go through it before you even get started. So you could think about, you know, what you're going to be doing before you start doing it, because as John pointed out, it's much easier that way versus, you know, you're 95% done and all of a sudden you've looked at this checklist and now you feel like you have to rewrite everything, and which can be a daunting task. And what usually ends up happening is you're like piecemealing fixes and band-aids instead of making a high quality site from the beginning. So keep that in mind.
All right, Sobi, before we wrap it up here, there's an event coming up at the end of this month, and how can, related to WP Campus, what do people need to know and how can they participate in that event?
So WP Campus Online is Tuesday, January the 30th, so coming up in about 2 weeks. I can't wait. I'm so excited. If you go to online.wpcampus.org, it is a free event. All you have to do is go to the site on that day. And there'll be a watch page. There'll be a watch page for each track. There's two tracks. So there'll be two sessions going on in each hour from 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. So 7 a.m. my time. That'll be an early morning. All the way to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time. So you open that page. We use a technology called Crowdcast, which is really great. There's an embed on the page. I don't think you have to register. I don't think you have to make an account with Crowdcast. So I think it's fairly straightforward to get in. And you just get in there and there's a chat room. I think you may have to have the account to like join in the chat. So, but there's a chat room where you can chat with other attendees. You can ask questions for the speakers, things like that. So we invite you all to join us. Like I said, it's free and we would love to have you join the conversation.
Awesome. Do you know of any, educational facilities or whatever that actually pipe in that the free online virtual WP Campus where, you know, they have a room full of people watching it?
Yeah. I know several universities are doing it. They did it last year and they've mentioned they're doing it again. They'll just rent out a room with a big monitor. You know, it's a campus. So every room has a screen and, right. they'll reserve two rooms. And just have them run all day so people can kind of come in and out and watch
other people
and stuff like that and bring snacks, stuff like that. I know a few universities that do it every year. So that's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. Well, I want to thank you again for being on the show and congrats on turning a tweet into a reality and really seeing it through. Thank you for all the work that you do both in the realm of accessibility and WordPress in higher ed. Go Buckeyes. Oh, wait, I didn't mean to say that. My bad. But it could have been the Buckeyes, damn it. Anyways, however, Alabama won a hell of a game. They got their championship, so congrats to them. Again, thank you. And any final words, John, before we let Rachel go on about her day?
No, it was just awesome to actually get to sit and chat with you. I feel like even seeing you at WordCamp US for like the past year or two that we haven't gotten to sit down and hang out or do anything.
You mean see her in passing?
Yes, right. Like, hello, hi, and then like walking to the event and then like, okay, I'll see you later, and then like never seeing you again. So this is fun. Thanks for hanging out.
Pretty much.
Thanks for having me. I love fun.
So how could people follow you on the Twitters and elsewhere on the web?
So I'm pretty much Bama Designer anywhere and everywhere. So BamaDesigner.com is kind of a landing page for a lot of my information. And then you can find me on Twitter at Bama Designer.
Excellent. Enjoy. Can't wait to check it out. And again, that's Tuesday, January 30th. And we'll have links to the event on the show notes page. Rachel, thanks again. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. Thank you.
Bye, Rachel.
Bye.
Awesome. So that was Rachel Cherry, an awesome interview. Once again, John, covered a lot there with regards to WordPress and higher ed and accessibility. There's a couple of things I want to talk about before we wrap up the show here. The first one being that WordPress 4.9.2 dropped yesterday. It patches a cross-site scripting vulnerability in the Flash fallback files within the media element library. Now, according to Ian Dunn in the announcement post, the Flash files are rarely needed and have been removed from WordPress. So if it turns out you actually need these Flash fallback files, you can get them using a media element Flash fallback plugin. Two different people are credited with responsibly disclosing the vulnerability. In addition to the patch, about 21 bugs were fixed, including JavaScript errors that prevented saving posts in Firefox has been fixed, and switching themes will attempt to restore previous widget assignments even if no sidebars exist. So there's a couple different things there that were fixed. Most sites out there should be updated by now. If you don't have auto updates turned on, you want to make sure to trigger it automatically or get updated to 4.9.2 when you can. Yeah.
The interesting backstory for this is that
there's always a backstory.
There is, especially with this one, because those Flash files were they have been fallbacks for years, and Flash has largely fallen kind of off the wayside of the web slowly, and then very quickly, and now it's, you know, we kind of just don't really rely on it the way we used to, and so those files also sort of fell out of maintenance by the original developers. And for some of these were forks so that WordPress could maintain its own version of those SWF files. And to be honest, there is a community of PHP and now more JavaScript developers than ever before, but with fewer and fewer ActionScript developers in and available and contributing, including those files, as more different and unique little edge case type things keep coming through. Removing them is the right thing to do, and hopefully there is not a lot of fallout from that, and on to bigger and better, and out with the old and in with the new. So it's very rare that you end up completely forking something and maintaining your own copy of it instead of just contributing upstream and having everybody be happier for it. So
well, I mean, what's the SWF upload, right? Or PL SWF upload? Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. Didn't they do the same thing? They forked the project, but they forked it because they tried to contribute upstream with the developers or development kind of ceased to exist, and there was no maintenance going on, so they had to fork it in order to make sure that they had a secure version, and there you go. So I mean, it isn't the first time they've had to fork a library to keep it maintained.
Yep.
Another big release back on a few days ago, Gutenberg 2.0 was released, and it contains a changelog. I'm not joking with you. It's about 3 miles long.
Yeah, it is.
Changelog. So it has a lot of improvements, enhancements from all the different blocks. A couple notable things is that copy and pasting have been significantly improved. A couple of things have been redesigned.
There's a thing. There's a thing I don't like about it. I mean, I don't want to interrupt you. And this isn't Gutenberg.
But you just did, so you might as well go all the way.
I kind of don't like the little fly out publish
Publish flow. Okay.
I kind of don't like that. I kind of feel like hitting publish is sort of like it's go time. Like I am for sure already done. It's like keys in the door and I'm ready to open the knob, or it's like I sit in the car, keys in, and instead of turning the ignition, there's someone comes out of the back seat and says, "Hey, are you sure you want to start the car? Are you sure you've checked everything? Is there oil in it? Is it fight idea? Is it in park? Like, let's check all the things before you start the car."
Well, I have accidentally published something I didn't mean to publish, and I've had to take it off, and it becomes a huge pain in the rear, which is why I installed a plugin called Publish Confirmation. So when I hit the publish button accidentally, it says, "Are you sure you want to publish?" And
You're not alone.
I'm damn sure I want to publish now before I actually hit the publish button. So,
and you are not alone. And so clearly there is an audience and a need for this but I don't like it.
Okay, fine. That's fine. You don't like it. Fine, whatever. Right. But I enjoy it. I enjoy a confirmation.
Everything else about Gutenberg 2.0 is great. That part, I'm not a fan.
So, you know, there's components. There's actually a lot of improvements to accessibility, such as area labels to code and HTML blocks. There's that warning now if multiple H1 headings are being used.
Yep.
Improved accessibility of menu items and the main ellipsis menu, missing tooltips to icon buttons. There's also improvements to mobile, block API, miscellaneous. I mean, there's so much stuff in here that you really, if you haven't tested or tried Gutenberg in a while, 2.0 is a good time to get reacquainted with it and try it out. There's a lot of stuff to go through in here. So definitely check that out. And last but not least, speaking of Gutenberg, Zach Gordon, who is, from what I've heard, is a terrific educator, has launched his Gutenberg development course and includes more than 30 videos, a dozen example blocks, access to support forums, and a community-run Slack channel. What it does is it covers how Gutenberg works, how to extend and customize it, and use a modern JavaScript development approach. So there's quite a few people who have already taken the course and said it's pretty in-depth, and it really gives you an inside look at how Gutenberg works, Gutenberg of today works, and how to extend things. And like, for example, James Tryon, he commented, he says, the course is very dense. I had to rewatch sections a couple of times before it started to click. And for him, less than five was his favorite. He says it was well worth the money. So so far, Zach's gaining a lot of fans with this course. And Jason Casabona has actually released a course as well in collaboration with Zach. I believe his course is more towards the end user perspective of Gutenberg, which I'm going to take a look at some point. And I believe this Friday, Zach, Jason, and Daniel Backhuber are going to get together on a live sort of Ask Me Anything about Gutenberg. And they're going to talk about a lot of geeky development topics related to
Gutenberg. Well, this is what we talked about with Gutenberg every single episode, where for anyone who's paying attention, it is a huge opportunity to kind of show everyone what it is that you've got and what you're able to help others with. Zach's able to leverage this with education. Backhuber is brilliant at everything he does, so it's no surprise that he's involved in helping. And so this is, and it goes back to what, again, Matt said last week, which is if you don't like change, you will like irrelevance less. So everyone who's pivoting to start talking about Gutenberg and embracing that change that's coming and talking about all angles of it, development, JavaScript, RESTful stuff, GraphQL, teaching the user side of it, posting, publishing, Markdown, all these new things that are going to come with blocks and everything. It's this is a huge opportunity for everyone to jump on. And so it's great to see these folks doing that.
Now, did you see the article? I believe it was on Delicious Brains, written by Elaine. It says, is Gutenberg the end or a new beginning for WordPress? And I read this article and I came away with, based on the content of the article, I came away with thinking that his opinions are that the Gutenberg we have of today is what's going to ship with WordPress, and it's going to cause issues, and there will be plugins that break and what have you. And that it's not going to be a particularly good situation, but that's just not the way it's going to be. I mean, the Gutenberg of today is going to be vastly improved by the time it merges with Core. And as we learned in the interview with Matt has a list of like critical things that need to occur before it can even be considered for merging to Core. And one of those is buy-in from the top plugins, the most popular plugins. So we're talking about Yoast SEO and ACF and some of the other popular ones that are out there, maybe even WooCommerce, you could throw that in as well. Sure. And then if you look at, people are kind of still freaking out about ACF and some of these other plugins, but The main developer of Advanced Custom Fields plugin already announced that Gutenberg compatibility is very high, or in fact is on the top of their priority list for 2018. There's a number of other plugin developers who have announced that Gutenberg compatibility is on their radar. Yoast is knee-deep in working on compatibility and how they can interface with Gutenberg. So, you know, it's not going to be an issue where Gutenberg ships with Core as is now and everything's just going to go to hell in a handbasket. That's not the way it's going to work. And in addition, as we learned in our interview with Matt, there's going to be substantial effort on a transition period. A transition plan is going to be put into place. In fact, Daniel Backhuber is going to be helping out with that, with his relationships with a lot of the popular plugin developers. And this is going to be a strategic rollout. And as we've, Matt is taking, you know, this is a very, important part of the rollout process for Gutenberg is the transition period. And so, you know, I think we're sort of, there's a lot of people out there who are sort of freaking out about it. We talk about this all the time when we bring up Gutenberg, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And some of that is, of course, justified if you're not, if you don't know the deep internals of Gutenberg, its philosophies and where it's going to be going. But there are people I trust, and there are teams, and there are plans, and there are things that are going to happen to where I bet the whole Gutenberg transition is going to be a lot less problematic as a lot of people probably think it's going to be.
I agree. I think you know that I agree. But I love how human of a response that it is to, like, because we're the reason why humans are so successful is because we are so dependent on one another. It's not like we are ants that are just crawling around, that we require a colony to accomplish anything of any sort of enormity. And so when any one of us sees danger in the world, something that we think is going to negatively impact our friends, our people, our folks, our colony, we're right in the post that says, this is what I see. You might not see it, but I see it. There's danger over there. It's going to be inconvenient. There's going to be blocks falling on our heads. We're going to have our pets' heads are falling off. There's going to be all this stuff that's going to happen. And so you have to appreciate that, even though it may not be 100% accurate, that everyone is sounding the alarm at what they see so that everyone else doesn't have to suffer through that same problem. And so I agree. It will be less of a big deal than some of the buzz is. But at the same time, it's not wrong, because the first time you activate something in Gutenberg, there's a lot that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of work that has to happen to make those things work. And so it's important that we have a long enough, comfortable period of time for all of that work to happen in tandem. And so far, it seems like it has been pretty successfully.
So that's about it. That wraps it up for the news section of, I guess I could give a congratulations, a shout out to WP Engine. They secured, I think it was $250 million in funding.
Saw that too. It was great.
That was near the beginning of the year. So congrats to them. Mm-hmm. A lot of
Liquid Web launched their
That's a huge story actually that I'm working on. Liquid Web actually launched a managed WooCommerce hosting, and we're not, you know, and it's not just WooCommerce bolted onto a hosting plan. It is top to bottom dedicated to WooCommerce with detailed analytics reporting. Really takes WooCommerce to a new level from what I've seen of it.
Chris gave me the rundown a few times throughout the year just on progress as it's gone. So I've gotten some miniature scoops here and there. And just like I guess I've come to expect from Chris Lemma and the folks that he hangs out with, is everything is going super good and largely right on schedule. And solving really, really super hard problems with really smart people and keeping them happy is kind of what Chris is all about. So I'm super excited to see where they take their Woo hosting and who's going to try and do something next. So it's an exciting time and space for sure.
Yeah. So I wonder, I mean, I've not tried it out yet for myself, but if, you know, they added a lot of ease of use, or they've really simplified the process and do all the managing of a WooCommerce store, I wonder if something like Liquid Web's product could really jumpstart even more so of WooCommerce's market share or usage. You know, maybe a lot more people who don't want to manage a WooCommerce store or see it as a giant pain in the ass when it comes to managing it and being compliant and dealing with all this stuff on your own server. You go. Now you have a solution. You just pay a service to do it all for you. And on top of that, get this awesome reporting tool and analytics to where you can really manage your store. So,
and we've talked about it before, but the hosting an e-commerce store, particularly through WordPress, you may as well not even be using WordPress. It's just such a different environment that's required to make that run and work, specifically because your users are interacting with your site and adding stuff to a shopping cart, and they're not logged in users. Page caching, output caching, all this stuff.
And you start talking about, you know, once you start getting into products and variations of products, things can scale out of control pretty quickly.
And WordPress has had solutions for these problems for 10 plus years. It's not really like it's really that complex of a problem to solve, but tuning it for your web host and for the environment that all this is in and getting it right, particularly when it comes to people's money, when they're paying you and it's your bottom line as a business, it's a super smart strategy to focus on this side and aspect of the market, because all those little implementation details are taken care of, and you have a turnkey solution to solving all of the problems that most traditional WordPress sites don't really need to solve right away. So super smart.
Yep. So let's get into our picks of the week. John doesn't have one, so we'll have to share mine once again. You know, sharing is caring here on this show.
I'm going to make up my pick of the week, and it's going to have nothing to do with WordPress at all. That's what mine's going to be.
So my pick isn't really, it's not a piece of software or anything like that. It's actually a blog post, and it's by Pippin Williamson. And it's the one where he does a 2017 year in review. And there's a couple reasons why I made this my pick. Is first, it's very personable in terms of the type of reviews that are out there. It includes a lot of things, personal challenges, personal achievements, and includes many things throughout 2017 that affected him throughout the business, including the very difficult task of having to fire two employees. He mentions that in the post. It's just a really good sort of look into what started off as a business owner, solopreneur, growing the business, talks about the benefits of turning on automatic renewals and how that's really created an influx of cash into the business, and turning off discounts for products, renewals, and how that's affected the business. And it's just filled with a lot of great stuff. So I highly encourage our listeners to check it out. So 2017 year in review by Pippin Williamson. In fact, I'm going to work on getting him on the show, because I think there's so much good stuff just in his year in review that we could cover here on the show that I think would be applicable and informative to many in our audience who may be in either a similar position or navigating the seas as a business owner or solopreneur. Yep.
And because he's done this every year since 2012, you automatically have like a progression and an archive to keep you busy on his site for like hours if you just keep reading. The Pippin has a way of writing all, like, being very detailed and transparent with all of everything that is happening and going on, in a way that doesn't over expose any details or have it come off in any way is like pretentious. It's all about learning and giving back and the education and the experience of it all. And kind of the struggles and the learning experience of trying to run a company and employ people. I mean, it's a kind of deeply personal thing. So this would have been my pick of the week if it wasn't yours.
And I just love the fact that he's been able to establish a passionate community of not only of the people who are huge fans of his business and his products, but of him personally. You get to see that through the comments on his site when he publishes some personal things like this. So, I mean, like I said, and I've said this in different episodes, where Pippin, you know, if there's ever like a WordPress number one boss, you know, poll that goes around, you know, I think Pippin would be a strong candidate to win, you know, WordPress boss of the year. you know, I say, I mean, I hope Matt's not listening, but I mean, you know, I mean, Matt's an awesome boss and all that. I'm just saying, you know.
Okay.
It's a given. Matt would not, I don't know, Matt's too awesome. He would automatically, whatever. You know, I'm already in enough trouble. But, you know, if there was a great boss of the, I mean, you know, you now work for Pippin. I've talked to other people who work for Pippin, and Pippin is an awesome boss. He cares about your well-being. He wants you to take care of yourself first before business. And, you know, there's just, I see nothing but great qualities regarding him as both a human being and as a boss. And and that comes across in some of the things he talks about in his year in review and some of the decisions now that his company makes. You know, is this best for our team and for the company? And if so, okay, let's do it.
And I can, in my brief few weeks of working on a bunch of different stuff across the board, honestly, I can confirm that all of those things are true. I mean, it's putting together a small company and keeping the culture the way that you want it, and making sure that everyone is around and active and heard and valued and empowered. Like, these are all like typical small business things, but he really tries hard to maintain all of that. And I know that I don't want to speak for him because I'd let him tell the story, but in his post, it covers more than software. It's not just easy digital downloads. It's all of the other things that the company and the employees that he has are working on that are development without being software development. So I don't want to, you know, spoil the whole thing for everybody, but it's a great post. So
that's my pick of the week. All right.
My pick is total garbage because we haven't really gotten the chance to hang out for like a long period. We hung out with Matt on episode 300 after the holidays. But there's more interesting stuff to talk about when we're talking about Gutenberg and celebrating the 300 and everything. And so since this episode's already long, and since I don't have a good WordPress pick of the week this week, that isn't me just talking about, like, you know, we've got the old forums migrated into BBPress 2.6. I sent you some screenshots. I would use that as my pick of the week, but that's like an us thing. That doesn't count. But Carrie got me a Nintendo Switch for Christmas.
Oh, boy.
And so I finally had the opportunity to play Zelda Breath of the Wild. And there is a reason why it's like everybody's game of the year. Like, it's a super, super good game that like keeps this, like, everything that everybody loves about that franchise like is there, plus like a bunch of other really cool stuff. I don't know. It's hard to, you know, it's like all the free time is like, oh, well, I was sitting around watching TV. Let's grab the Switch and start playing some games or something. I don't know. It makes me feel like I'm playing cool old Zelda again and discovering cool new things. It's just a really good game. So
that Mario game for the Switch looks pretty cool.
It does look pretty cool. I kind of want to take on one big giant time suck at a time. There's like all this other stuff. It's like, I want to paint. I want to do stuff to the house. I want to like.
So just really quickly, if it's possible for you to do something really quickly, what's your review of the user interface, the controls for the Switch?
So they're great. They're fine. Okay. They're exactly what, like, if you ever used a Wii, it's like the same layout as a Wii. They're just bolted onto the little screen. I don't mind holding it, you know, like old Sega Game Gear. Do you ever have one of those? Yeah. Big, wide. It's kind of what it's like. It's kind of big when you're holding onto it and playing with it, but like the controls are totally fine. The shoulder buttons are fine. It's easy, super easy to get used to.
Right.
So that alone wouldn't be the reason not to get one. In fact, I think Nintendo did a really good job of like making it look pretty sleek and kind of like classy, upscale looking, because it's dark and black and there's like no, like you can get the blue and the red controllers and stuff, but like out of the box, it just looks really, I don't know, it looks like professional.
By the way, Nintendo Switch, best-selling console in 2017.
I know, it's incredible. It's absolutely
just when you think Nintendo is going to be irrelevant, they come out with something that just puts them back in the line. I mean, they did that with the Wii. Mm-hmm. I mean, they came out with that, and everyone's like, it's going to be gimmicky and everything. No, it exploded. You couldn't get it for months.
And Tom McFarlane tweeted, and I totally hadn't even considered it, that Breath of the Wild came out on the Wii originally. It wasn't even for the Switch. I had no interest in buying it for the Wii, but the Switch is such a, it just is portable. It looks like kind of like it's got the same Nintendo sort of friendliness to it. Like it feels very inviting because it feels very simple, but it looks, you know, like a Ferrari. Like it looks all designed really well. And so you feel like you're holding like a kind of quality heavy duty thing, but then it's super fast and it all the interface is really like fun and simple. And so I know that they have like apparently there's like a big Nintendo announcement tomorrow. What's the date today? Tomorrow. But I don't know what it is. I haven't checked to see it. And I don't really play video games as much as I used to, but like whoever at Nintendo is like running the show for real today, like right now, they're like, they went back to the roots. They're like making a solid console with really good games. They're very immersive. It's just, I really love the lessons that video game design can teach us about what it is that we're trying to accomplish and do for the web, specifically with stuff like Gutenberg and leveling up and tutorials. Like there's just a lot. I've talked about it before, but just Breath of the Wild is just a killer, killer game. That's my pick. Nothing bad to say about it yet, other than just it's huge.
Right.
Like the open world is enormous. Like it's like Gutenberg complexity to a million. Like it's just there's just so much you can do all over the place that you will miss huge parts of the game because you just never even considered that something was possible. But I don't know. It's neat. It's fun.
So there you have it, folks. Bit of console review to round out today's episode. Weekly. If you're
Nintendo Weekly.
So next week we have a epic interview lined up with the one and only Brian Gardner, founder of Studio Press. And I'm very much looking forward to that show because it's going to be one of those episodes like with Corey Miller where I get to talk about, get all nostalgic and talk about some of the awesome things that have happened over the years. Mm-hmm. And can't wait to hear from him and some of the experiences and challenges he's overcome with running a theme business and kind of get his take on, maybe get his take on Gutenberg or just his take on themes in general of today, the WordPress mm-hmm. themes of today and how things have changed over the years and where he sees things in the future.
I bet he knows
a thing or two about that.
It's possible that there are people listening to the podcast right now who don't really even know who Brian is, right?
Oh, yeah. It's possible.
I'm interested to see how the conversation, like where are you? Our conversation starts and ends because there's a lot we could we could talk about. So yeah. I'm really excited to talk to Brian too.
So you can find show notes for this episode and all other episodes on WPTavern.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at JeffroJeffr0, where hopefully I don't give you part of the plague I had. Hope you don't get that through a tweet.
Or just like through the ears, through the headphones, like keep that in your office. Nobody needs
John,
that.
Where can we stalk you on the internet?
GitHub and Twitter at JJJ and JJJ.blog.
So everybody enjoy the rest of your week. We'll talk to you again next Wednesday afternoon. So long, everybody. Say bye, John.
Bye, John.